Welcome to the Student of the Game Fire Podcast with your host, Danny B. Today's guest is Andy Saccadato, 20 years of combination experience, Fire Instructor 2 with Tennessee Fire Codes Academy, former firefighter slash driver operator with the Charlottesville Fire Department in Virginia, where Andy served for 9 years, owner and creator of the Water Thieves LLC, and author of Water Thievery, The Art of Water Supply Operations. If you are a current or aspiring driver operator and want to know the ins and outs of pumping, moving water more than what your organization gives you, Andy is most certainly the subject matter expert when it comes to this particular field. In this interview, we discuss pumping, moving water, the importance of the driver-operator role, and a few other topics. Andy was genuine and sincere in all his answers and truly wants to leave the fire service better than he found it. I thoroughly hope all passionate drivers enjoy the interview. With that, I present Andy Saccadato.
All right. My name's Andy Saccadato. I started in the fire service as a volunteer at the age of 16 with the Chatham Township Volunteer Fire Department up in New Jersey. Started as a junior member, and from the second I got into the fire service, walked in that front door, I knew that this is what I wanted to do as a career. Before that, I was kind of bouncing between a couple different things, but that first junior drill really solidified it for me that this was my calling and this is what I wanted to do. So I went to college for fire science to New Jersey City University. I went there for 3 years, and in my right before I started my senior year, I got hired with the city of Charlottesville, Virginia. So I moved to Virginia as a fireman and worked there for 9 years. Spent the majority of my time as a driver operator, and then I left there to take the job that I currently have with the state of Tennessee, overseeing the pump and aerial programs at the State Fire Academy. And I also run my own business that I started while I was working in Charlottesville called the Water Thieves LLC. And it's basically just teaching advanced pump operation stuff and just how to move water. So I really love truck operations, pump operations, and actually moving water and operating fire apparatus. And it's kind of my passion, and that's kind of what we do.
Okay. All right. Before I start asking you current questions that I definitely want to deep dive in, when you started out, was there any family members that directed you towards the fire service, or was that something you were like, at a very young age, this is what I want to do?
Yeah, so I did. My father was not a fireman, so I didn't have, like, you know, a lot of guys say, you know, my father was a fireman, so I became a fireman. I didn't have that direct influence, but I had a couple cousins who were firemen in other agencies, a couple second and third cousins that were members of the fire department that I ended up joining in the town that I was in. And then my grandfather, he helped found a rescue squad in a neighboring town where my dad grew up and everything like that. So there was some family ties, but not the traditional, like my dad was a fireman or my grandfather was a fireman, right? Neither of them were firemen. It was more influence from distant relatives that were actually firemen. That kind of sparked my interest in joining the fire department. And then once I got in there, it was game over.
Okay. Okay. And so, of course, you got on, you joined as a volunteer, and you were like, all right, this is what I want to do for a career. How did Charlottesville happen? Did you, when you knew you wanted to go career, did you apply any and everywhere, or was Charlottesville like a target for you?
Yeah. So, when I started as a junior member, you know, this was 2006. So I started trying to figure out, well, what do I have to do to get hired in New Jersey, this, that, and the other. And in New Jersey at the time, they were very much civil service testing. Most of the localities were based on the civil service test. And there were a couple things that you really had to do. The biggest one in order to be eligible for certain jurisdictions was you had to have residency. So if I wanted to work for the Newark Fire Department, which big city, a lot of fire, a lot of fire duty, very aggressive, definitely a fire department that I wanted to work for, I would have to move to Newark. And, you know, I would potentially have to live there for 3 to 5 years and just hope that my number got called. So I knew that at that time, like, that was a possibility. I considered it at the young age, but I also wanted to go to college. So I went to New Jersey City University, started working on my fire science degree, my bachelor's in fire science. And while I was there, you know, the other big thing with the civil service test in the state of New Jersey was they give a lot of preference to veterans. And at the time when I was trying to get on the job, we had a lot of guys coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. And the way the civil service test worked, if you were a non-vet that didn't see active duty or combat duty, you were not going to get hired. I know the bigger departments, Newark and Jersey City, they were hiring full recruit classes, 40 guys plus. All of them were vets and no non-vets. So that was one of the things that I kind of had to deal with. And I had a professor at New Jersey City University who retired with the FDNY. And he was like, listen, all of you guys, you know, if you want to get hired, you're fooling yourselves in this time, at this time, if you think you're going to get hired in the state of New Jersey, you guys need to be looking elsewhere just because of how, you know, the residency requirements were and the military service was. And a lot of us, myself included, I personally didn't want to join the military and get shot at before I could go fight fire, right? So he encouraged all of us to go and apply out of state. He said, if there's a test somewhere, I don't care where it is, go take it. And part of that was really to get us the experience of what that testing was going to be like, what that whole thing was going to be like. So in 2 years, I probably tested for 13 different fire departments up and down the East Coast, as far south as Charlotte, North Carolina, and as far north as Ithaca, New York. So I was shotgun blasting. And I remember the first time I tested with Charlottesville, I went, I took the test. I you know, did my research and I'm like, man, this is a really cool city. Like, this is awesome. I really wouldn't mind working here. Some of the other places were like, man, I'm just here because I need it. I need the experience. Like, if I get hired, that's great, but I don't really care if I work here or not. Mm-hmm. But Charlottesville felt different. So the first go around, I made it to a second round interview and I didn't get the job. I later found out that a lot of the reason was because I was from out of state and there was some hesitation hiring, you know, a 20-year-old kid from New Jersey relocating to Virginia. They were concerned if the guy was going to stay. And I don't fault them at all for that. Right. You know, I got that rejection letter and I filed it away, but I said to myself, man, I got to pay attention because if Charlottesville comes up again, I really wouldn't mind working there. So about a year later, they were hiring again. I applied and I got hired. So it was kind of like, holy crap, I can't believe it worked out, and it worked out the way it was supposed to, and I'm really happy with how it worked out. But yeah, that's kind of how I landed in Charlottesville. It wasn't, at first, it wasn't something like, man, I got to work for the city of Charlottesville. But when I tested the first time, I was like, this is a cool city that definitely has the potential to, you know, see a lot of fire duty, have a lot of experience, it's a cool part of the country. And I was fortunate enough that I persevered and got hired.
Okay. And so you get the acceptance letter. Did you have to do any sort of recruit academy, or was it kind of like a little 1 or 2 week orientation, then they onboarded you?
Yeah. So at the time when I came through, so I had already had my Fire 1, my Fire 2, my Fire Officer stuff through New Jersey. But at the time, the state of New Jersey wasn't Pro Board or ISAC or anything like that. So they hired me, but they're like, listen, none of your certifications are going to transfer over. You're going to have to redo everything. It's like, okay, no problem. But the city of Charlottesville at that time, I got hired with two other guys. So it was a group of three. The other two guys already had their stuff in Virginia, and they basically they went right on to shift. The fire department as a whole at that time wasn't big enough to do their own recruit school. Mm-hmm. So basically what happened, the deputy chief, Chief Grimm, was like, listen, you have the certifications. They don't have the state of Virginia seal on them. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to count you as minimum staffing to begin with, but we're going to enroll you in a firefighter one, firefighter two class, and you're going to retake it. So the firefighter one class that I ended up having to retake, was in a neighboring volunteer fire department. So that was pretty cool. You know, I got to go through a firefighter one class again with, some volunteer folks and do that. And then we did an in-house firefighter two class. So me and another guy who had no experience, that got hired on after me could kind of get all the stuff that he needed. So yeah, I did not have the true, you know, recruit school experience like a lot of other bigger fire departments had. Mm-hmm. But you know, the fire department now, the city of Charlottesville, they are doing a recruit school style thing. They're usually the last couple classes that they've had at least 10 people. So they've been doing their own, you know, several week recruit class experience. So,
okay. And so you get all that knocked out, you get the Virginia seal of approval. What was it like being a career firefighter in Charlottesville? Like it was your experience.
Man, it was unbelievable. So, you know, I saw things that I never thought I would see. You know, the city of Charlottesville is only 10 and a half square miles, you know, in size. So geographically, it's a small city, but it's so densely populated. I forget the last data I looked at, but it's like third or fourth most densely populated city in the state. So, and a lot of that's because of the University of Virginia. So I got to see things as, you know, being growing up as a kid in Chatham Township, suburbia, New Jersey, that I never thought I was going to see. And, you know, all the way from people that were on the higher end of, you know, wealth, you know, $1 million homes, all kinds of crazy stuff, to, you know, people in the projects. And they could be two blocks away from each other in some instances. And that just, it blew my mind that the world was like that. So it was a really eye-opening experience. It was something that I wouldn't trade for anything in the world. And it really not only shaped me as a fireman, but man, it shaped me as an adult. Like, I just got so much life experience working in that city and just, you know, for lack of a better phrase, being thrown to the wolves as far as, you know, life expectancy or life experience. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, I worked with other guys that were my age, but a lot of them grew up in the Charlottesville area. So some of them were living at home while they were, you know, 21, 22, 23, 25, right? And working at the fire department. Me, I had to learn real quick because mommy and daddy were still in New Jersey. I'm 21 years old. I'm 6 hours from home. And, you know, not only do I have a serious job now, but I'm on my own. So mm-hmm. It was one hell of a learning experience for me. And I'm so grateful for it. It was scary, right? It was definitely scary, but I would definitely encourage anybody that is looking to join the fire service or, you know, questioning, man, could I move across the country for this job? Could I go a couple states away? Man, it's not easy, but it is so rewarding. It is so rewarding because I truly feel that I got to set my own path, right? And as an adult and as a fireman, right? The city of Charlottesville was really cool from a fire duty perspective. We joked around and called it the safest city in America, right? Because we would go all the time, and things that you're sitting there saying, man, this guy's a hoarder, and his freaking mattress was on fire, but the whole house didn't catch on fire. Like, how did we not burn the block down? Anywhere else in the United States, this would have been a three alarm fire, right? But we were very fortunate that because we were 10 and a half square miles with three fire stations, we were bam, 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 apparatus wise, getting there really quick. And then I would be remiss if I didn't bring up the fact that I worked for a fire department that had a tractor drone aerial, right? So, that's an experience that I got that, they're becoming more prevalent, but not everybody has that experience to till or drive the tractor. And I'll be honest, that was the hardest part about leaving the Charlottesville Fire Department was leaving that tractor drone aerial, right? But, it is what it is.
You mentioned that you left there after a 9-year career as a pretty much as a driver. How did you decide that was your passion, and when did you decide, like, I want to start moving up the ranks to be able to do that?
Yeah, so I'll be honest, it a lot of things kind of came and happened in my life all at once. It was not an easy decision. But I had started my business teaching through the Water Thieves probably, let's see, 2 years prior. So my business was starting to gain traction. I was starting to go different places and teach, and I started to feel like, when I got out and taught, that I was actually having the ability to provide some really memorable and I was actually starting to have an impact on people beyond my circle. And that was really cool, to kind of share the knowledge and help other people, other firemen, right? Obviously, you're helping people in the community on the job, but to be able to help firemen and give them things to therefore help other people. So that was really cool. I'll be 100% honest. Part of what made the decision to leave easy was when I got hired in Charlottesville, we did not have any ambulances. We were running first response off the engines, and I loved it, right? I got to see a lot of cool stuff, got to provide some care, but I didn't have to worry about the transport stuff, or even if it was a BS call, right? Okay, this is BS. We hand them off to the transport agency, and then we're gone. Well, we got we the administration went a route where they ended up bringing fire-based ambulances into the fire department. So we ended up putting two ambulances in service, staffing them. One was 24 hours a day. One was a peak ambulance that worked about 12 hours a day. And we did all that without increasing our staffing. So we were, at the time when I was still there, a lot of that was being staffed with overtime. So the schedule that we worked, it goes by, I had a bunch of people call it a bunch of different things, but we worked 24 on, 24 off, 24 on, 24 off, 24 on, and then we had 4 days off. So, and in our fire department at the time, I don't know if it's still this way, you could be held on that first day and end up working a 72-hour shift, right? That was a very routine occurrence that they would have to hire, mandatorily hold somebody, and you'd work a 72-hour shift. So that was happening, right? So I was working 72-hour shifts. I would get a day off. I would come in for the last day of my cycle, and then get mandatorily held on the next day. So 72, day off, 48, and then 3 days off. And it was killing me. I was an ornery son of a bitch. It was killing me. And I wasn't even a paramedic or anything, right? I was just an EMTB. So that coupled with the fact that at the time I was assigned to our tiller, truck nine, and on the days that was my normal shift day, there were more times than not I was getting floated off the ladder truck to go drive the ambulance. So I was like, nope, I'm done with this. This is awful. I hate this. This sucks, right? This really sucks. So I was ornery. I'm not gonna lie, I was ornery. And it got to the point where I realized, you know what? I really love teaching, right? I really love pumping. You know, the city of Charlottesville, I get to go to some fires, but man, I'm pumping more fire engines when I'm not at work than I am at work, right? Whether it be training or fires, whatever, because I volunteered while I worked for the city of Charlottesville. And I was like, you know, maybe I could do this. So that seed got planted in my head, and then I was teaching a class in Lawrenceburg, Tennessee, for the Lawrenceburg Fire Department, and they're right on the Tennessee-Alabama border, and those guys are firefighting sons of guns. Man, they go to some fire, and they're balls out firemen, and their fire chief at the time, he said, still their fire chief. He said to me after the class, he was like, Andy, you should do this for the state. I'm like, the hell are you talking about? He's like, you should teach this stuff for the State Fire Academy. I was like, I didn't even know y'all had a State Fire Academy. It's like, yeah, it's in Belbuckle, Tennessee. It's a campus, blah, blah, blah. I think they have an opening. You really need to apply. So I was like, well, why not? So I applied. And I got lucky enough, and it felt right, and I haven't looked back. So,
Okay, down to the meat and potatoes now. Where did your love of pumping come from? And was it something that an OG, an old salt dog taught you that you just took the ball and ran with it? Or I just want to pick your brain on where did your love of pumping come from?
yeah, so I have been blessed in my fire service career to have some fantastic mentors. You know, and I think my love of pumping comes from a blend of a lot of different ones. I'm going to start with my dad. My dad is a civil engineer. That's his profession. He built bridges and did all that, and very mechanically, mathematically, scientifically geared head. Brilliant man, but he was never a fireman, and he always told me, he's told me, you know, he's 67 now, and he has said he always wanted to be able to join the fire department and drive the trucks, but he just never had time because of what he was doing. He could not commit that time. So my dad and I share a lot of that mechanically geared head. So I get a lot of that interest in machinery and apparatus and all that from my father. So I knew when I joined the fire department at 16, like, I want to be able to drive these trucks. Like, that would be so cool. Like, yeah, I want to go inside and put out fire. But man, driving that ladder truck would be so cool, and operating that boom and all that stuff. So, I kind of walked in with that. My first drill as a junior, it was fate, but my first drill as a junior firefighter was hitting the hydrant, right? How to hit the hydrant. So I'm like, okay, man, this is pretty cool. I get water out of the fire hydrant, make the hose connections, all that. And I was like, man, this is great. So then I learned that in order to operate these trucks, you have to know how to pump them. Okay, that makes sense. I got to know how to operate the pump and the area and all this stuff. So I kind of started traveling that route. And while I was in Chatham, I was blessed to have probably one of the best mentors ever. His God rest his soul, Chief Tom Murray. He retired as the fire chief from the Summit Fire Department, and then he was a volunteer with us in Chatham. And Tom, man, he was your typical, stereotypical Irish fireman, right? Like, just as tough as nails, seen it all, and he was a water supply guru. In addition to being retired from Summit and volunteering with us, he was a mutual aid coordinator for Union County, New Jersey. So he would go anywhere in Union County if they had a fire and they called mutual aid coordinators. He'd be going to Elizabeth, all these urban areas, and helping with whatever. And a lot of times he ended up doing water supply stuff. So he instilled the importance of knowing hydrant mains, knowing, having map books, knowing, you know, what threads go with this city and this, that, and the other, and tip sizes and flows and all that. Like, he instilled the importance of that in me. So then I leave and go to Charlottesville, and I take a driver pump operator class because I want to be able to drive. And, you know, I left that class having more questions than I had answers to. So I started deep diving, answering my own questions, getting outside and doing stuff. And then I ran into my next mentor, which was John Burris, who retired from Charlottesville with 39 years of service. And John kind of took me under his wing. And he really cultivated. John was a truck guy through and through. He's a truck guy, aerial. He's a guru on aerial operations. And he kind of cultivated me to jump into the pump operation side, because at the time we didn't really have anybody that just loved it. And mm-hmm. and I was, he definitely saw that I had a spark and interest and wanted to. So he pushed me to do all that. He helped me take a class by another guy named Dale Dean, which was, he worked for Albemarle County, Virginia, our neighboring organization. And Dale passed on a lot of knowledge to me as well. And then with all that, I was like, man, this is great. Like, this is fun. I love doing it. I think I'm a passionate guy. That's at least what people tell me. So I think some of it got infectious and other people were asking me questions. And I was like, man, this is the best job, right? You and I were talking offline before about, you know, company officer being the best job that a lot of people say. I think it's a driver operator, right? Yep. And I know yep. you and I are on the same page with that, right? It's the best job because it's the one job that you get to, you know, yeah, you have a boss. The company officer is your boss, but you got to be smart. You have to operate by yourself mm-hmm. a lot of the times. You got to know what the hell you're doing, right? So yeah, and you're driving big trucks,
right?
With big toys, right? So yeah, that's, I know that's kind of a long answer, but that's kind of how I fell into it, and you know, I love it. I love getting to see what different trucks can do, what mm-hmm. people, mm-hmm. how people set their rigs up, and then actually letting them do what they're designed to do, not just sit in a bay and run yeah. EMS calls, right?
Yeah. Yeah. No, for sure. For sure. One of the things, so like, I always like to be transparent with the guests and anybody listening. So, you know, me and you were on the same page on how we feel about the driver operator role. One thing for me, though, I am not getting, and this is not a shot at my department because I talked to many others and they're like, I feel the same way. When it comes to finding classes that revolve around driver operator, there really aren't any that I know of. Meaning, and this is not a shot at any conference out there, but there's conferences on throwing ladders, stretching hose, search, forcible entry, ventilation. Like, we have all these classes for all these particular areas within the fire service, but there's really nothing for the driver operator course. And I was talking to Chief Watling in North Carolina a couple weeks ago, and it's one of those things like, why aren't conferences holding that? Because there's an audience for it. There are people who want to get better, myself included. So for North Carolina, we have to go through pump scenarios. That's what you got to get.
Yep.
And they go through the whole thing where you learn about centrifugal pumps, all the stuff that if you're going to be a driver operator, you should know. And I get it. And then it's, all right, this is your pressures, knowing your pressures, understanding trucks, pressure, volume. You know, the trucks back in the day aren't the same now. It's a lot different. You can kind of pretty much set it and forget it. But I feel like the art of knowing, having that intimate relationship with your pump, it's I don't want to say it's dying, because I see, at least with guys in the fire service now, guys and gals in the fire service now, when they go up for the promotion, it's, hey, just remember these numbers. Like, you can teach anybody to do it. Pull this lever, throttle up, make sure you're, and then like that's it. But I want to kind of go into why. I don't want to put you on the spot, but like, why is it that there aren't conferences out there that involve such an important role in the fire service? Because I truly feel like if everything goes good, nobody blinks an eye at the driver. But if they ask for water and you get it to them, but then something catastrophically happens and they don't have water, all eyes are on you.
Yeah, so I love the question. I love it. But it's multifaceted, right? And we need to be honest for a second, right? And this might offend some people, and I don't really care, but there's a couple reasons for it. The first one is attitude in the fire service. There are a lot of people in the fire service that think that being a pump operator is nothing but pull a couple line or pull a couple levers and get water out of the truck. And that's not what it is. That is not what it is. And people will joke with me all the time, and my mentor John Burris, he would do this to get under my skin. But he would screw with me all the time and say, "Man, all you need to know to be a pump operator is pump it till it's hard and add 10, right? That's all you need to know." And while it's a joke, that's how a lot of people look at it,
Yes.
right? And I think I'm not saying, and a lot of, and some people have taken my classes before and they're like, "Man, you focus way too much on moving big water. And we, that's on, let's, we'll never do that. Blah, 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 blah." Well, this is what I like to say. There's a couple reasons why I focus on big water. Number one, it's cool, right? If you can do that, you can pump a two-line house fire in
Right.
your sleep. That almost becomes boring. Number two, it gets you to think outside the box, right? You're thinking about what the capabilities of your rig are. But here's the other big thing, right? We're not in the business of what could happen, right? Or what does happen. We're in the business of what could happen, right? And I would say this, I had a battalion chief in Charlottesville that would get on me all the time about this. He was a big hazmat guy, right? But he'd get on me all that, "Man, we don't burn these like this," and blah, 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 blah. And I would tell him all the time, if all we're worried about is what actually does happen, we would have one fire engine and 15 ambulances, because that's what we do. We go to a lot of EMS calls. We don't go to a lot of fires every day. But no, what do we have? At the time, we had four engine companies, two ladder trucks, and two ambulances. Because if the downtown mall burns or whatever, you're going to need four engines, two aerials, and your mutual aid assignments to put this fire out, right? So part of it is the attitude that, you don't need that. Some of it is, if we're being honest, a lot of people are afraid to admit they don't know something.
That's right.
And historically, culturally, we're seeing a shift because the fire service as a whole is getting younger. But historically, when I stepped through the doors in the Charlottesville Fire Department, I was told, "You're not going to drive until you've been here at least 5 years." That was the senior man's position. And that's fine. Some of our senior men don't want to admit that, "Man, I didn't know that. I didn't know the pump could do that. I didn't know the truck could do that." And I'll be honest, that's a hard pill to swallow. If you've been doing something for a long time, you didn't know something. Like, I get it. We're all human, but I think that's part of it too. That's why there is an aversion in some organizations. I personally am seeing that shift because the fire service as a whole is becoming, it's so young, right? And when I was trying to get hired, when you were trying to get hired, right, you were going up against a lot of people.
Right.
Now, it is not like that. The candidate pools aren't like what they were. So you're getting a lot of people, not only are they young, but they have no fire experience, right? Whereas a lot of people before at least had maybe some volunteer experience, right? So that's shifting in a positive way, right? We're seeing younger and hungrier people, right? Here's the last reason, and I'll be 100% honest. why you don't see it at conferences and stuff like that. It's a logistical nightmare, all right? And, you know, I'll be honest, running my business, it can be difficult at times because I'm basically asking a fire chief or an organization, hey, you need to trust me. I'm going to take your million-dollar pumper today, and I'm going to show guys what it can do. And you have to trust me that I'm not going to blow your truck up, right? And we need to flow thousands and thousands and thousands of gallons of water from a fire hydrant. So you need to talk with your water department, make sure they don't get upset, right? So there's a lot of potential roadblocks. And then when you get into some of the more complex and showing people what you can really do from a water supply perspective, now not only do I need one pumper, but I need four. Oh, and give me your aerial platform so I can show you what that can do too. Right? So I got damn near $10 million worth of toys that I'm asking you to let me play with for a day. It's a logistical nightmare. And that's why, like, for me as a business owner, and when I teach my classes, the biggest pain in the butt class that I teach is my advanced hydrants class, right? Because, yeah, most fire departments give me the trucks. It's dealing with the water department. The water department doesn't want me to flow 500,000 gallons in a day. That's a lot of money, right? So those are the classes that more urban fire departments are interested on, but it's a struggle because there's that potential roadblock. The classes that I love teaching, I mean, I love teaching the hydrants class, but the easier class to teach is the drafting class. Give me a pond and I'll recycle all the water, right? And nobody wastes water, right? So yeah, it's a logistical headache. And I recognize that. That's why personally I am so absolutely thankful and grateful to Chief David Rhodes and FDIC and the entire FDIC committee for taking a chance on us this year and allowing us to do a hot class this year at FDIC on advanced drafting operations and maximizing your flow from static bodies of water. So we are super excited about that because, like you said, they recognize that there's a need, right? There's a need. There's people that want it, right? So we're really excited about that. If you're interested, please, anybody sign up, anybody listening, sign up. There are definitely going to be spots available for that. So, and I would say, even if you're an urban firefighter, right? Just because it's drafting, just because it's maximizing your rural water movement, there's stuff in there for you. There's stuff in there for the urban firefighter. Because let's be real, right? Things happen. It doesn't happen often, but there could be a day where major metropolitan cities have to draft, right? It happens. Water main breaks, right? Natural disasters, acts of terrorism, right? Or like, you know, some municipalities in the United States have seen, we got a big ripping warehouse fire and we're using hydrant water, but that water doesn't last forever. Eventually, you can run your town, your municipality low on water, and your water authority may come and start shutting your hydrants off to conserve water for the people that need drinking water. So now I need to supplement my fire scene with some type of static body of water or rural water tactic, right? So yeah, even the urban firefighters, there's something for you in that class, I promise you.
Now, you know, with me, I went through the classes. I continue to go whenever I can pick someone's brain. So like I got a guy in my department. I'm gonna give him a shout out because he is awesome. Jeff Russell. I think he took one of your classes, I think. He has a mustache kind of just like yours. Yeah. Awesome dude. He prepared me when I was going up for my assessment for lieutenant. He showed me a couple things that I told him right there. I was not afraid to say. I was like, Jeff, I've never seen that, but the way he explained it was like, okay. And I'm not ashamed to admit that, you know, as a driver, I only get that experience to what I'm able to see because My experience now is, all right, yeah, most of our house fires, two or three lines max. Maybe the first line off the ground, a second that might get charged, might not, and then, hey, we need your deck gun for a little bit. Like, that's all I know. And I want to know more. I want to be able to utilize that, which is crazy to say, million-dollar engine to its capabilities. And I understand chiefs don't want us to tear up equipment. I get it. But there's got to be a give and take somewhere, because I'm not one of those people where it's just, oh, you just need to know this number, pull this lever, that's it. You get your water, everything's good. If something happens, God forbid, to the truck, I want to be able to be like, okay, this is what's going on, and fix that. And so I love that you have that class, but I feel like too, like what are some things that people can do to help better educate themselves if they want to learn more about their truck?
Yeah, so here's what I'm this is why I absolutely love my job and what I get to do and what I do at the State Fire Academy, because one of the classes that I developed and that we provide at the Tennessee State Fire Academy is called Advanced Pump Operations. I'm actually wearing a shirt right now. And it's a 5-day class where we go over advanced drafting techniques, we go over how to deal with challenging rural water sources, and we spend time a whole day doing big water from hydrants, all right, and hydrant operations, all that good stuff, right? And it really is designed to cover all these things that most people don't get the opportunity to do in their fire department because of all the logistical hurdles. It's not knocking any fire department. It's just some it just can't be done everywhere unless it's on a fire. And on a fire ground is not the time to be figuring this out. So this is a class that we offer at our facility in Tennessee in Bell Buckle. It is open to anybody who's interested. Currently we're doing it 4 times a year. And all you need to do is if anybody's interested or needs more information, you can send me an email or reach out to me on social media or whatever, and I'll hook you up. But you can register for the class, and you can come down, take the class, do all these scenarios with apparatus that we have at the Fire Academy. So they're dedicated trucks that I don't have to worry about this rig has to go and cover station 9 or whatever. No, they're trucks at the Fire Academy, and that's all they live for. They live to be punished and pumped and operated and everything like that. So, that would be the biggest thing that I would recommend to anybody that's sitting here saying, man, I really want to do this stuff. Okay. And I'll be honest, I am a shitty businessman, right? Because what I should be doing is saying, you need to hire the water thieves to come out and teach and blah, blah, blah. And of course, I'd love to do that. I'll come to anybody's fire department and teach. But you know, it's a little bit more expensive because I got to haul a trailer and this, that, and the other, and we got to use your equipment, and we run into some of the logistical problems that we talked about. So the advanced pump operations class, you just got to get here, right? You got to pay your tuition, you got to get here. And for an out-of-state student, the cost for the tuition, the room and board, and the meals for the 5 days that you're there, it's right around $650, right? So it's very affordable. Very, very affordable to do. So that's one option. The other option, if your fire department isn't necessarily want to send you to Tennessee, but they want to host something and use their own equipment, totally great, right? Reach out to us. We'll be happy to come and schedule a class and do something to meet your needs. Some other options available to anybody that's interested. Something that I was involved with in a partnership with TFT. We did a couple video series on water supply operations, specifically on drafting operations in rural water. And then we did another video series on four-way hydrant valves and stuff like that. That was a partnership with TFT. All of those videos are free. They have checklists and stuff like that that you can, download for free and kind of, you know, do whatever and see. Something that I've been toying with, and I don't know, I have to figure some stuff out, but there were topics in the video series that we did with TFT that we wanted to cover, but we just could, we ran out of time and we just didn't. So something that I'm working on, I actually just recently, a couple months ago, I purchased a 1988 Mac from my volunteer fire department up in New Jersey. So I have that rig and I'm thinking about doing some educational videos on water supply utilizing the Mac. And, you know, doing stuff, and that'll all be free and be made available to cover some of the topics that we didn't get to. And then another option, if you're interested and actually want something in your hand, reading and all this, Fire Engineering is a great resource. They have a bunch of articles always posted on water supply stuff. Fire Apparatus and Emergency Equipment also has a lot of good references, articles, and stuff like that on a monthly basis. And then I wrote a book for Fire Engineering Books titled Water Thievery, The Art of Water Supply Operations. That is available on fireengineeringbooks.com or on Amazon. Either type my name in or the title of the book and it should pop up. But what I like to tell people is all the information that we teach in our advanced classes through my business is all in that book. So we cover all advanced hydrant operations, all kinds of big water supply operations, all kinds of rural water supply tactics. I have a chapter in there that talks about fire pump theory, just to make sure we're all on the same page. So there's something for everybody in that book, whether you're a rural firefighter or you're an urban firefighter, right? And then there's also Fire Engineering Books has a lot of other great authors that write on the water supply topic and even a truck company operations as well. So if you're looking for texts, definitely check out fireengineeringbooks.com and look under the apparatus section. There's plenty of great stuff that isn't mine that it's open. It's available to anybody.
Okay. All right. I'm going to go back to that chief that was like, you know, hey, you should come work for the state of Tennessee and do this. So when you decided, shoot, yeah, I'm going to do it. Is the water thieves just you? And if it's not, do you hand pick, like, how do you vouch for those? Because that way you want to make sure, of course, when you start any business, that whatever persons you bring on, they have that same knowledge and skill set. So do you personally vouch, like, because I could be like, hey, I want to work for you. Do you know anything about pumps? Yeah, sure. I just know the basics. Pull, set it, forget it, leave. But how do you vouch for those people?
Yeah, that's a great question. So a couple things that are important for me to highlight. So, you know, obviously I own my own business. That's a teaching company and I work for the state of Tennessee. So within the state of Tennessee, I cannot teach any of my water thieves classes within the state because it's a conflict of interest. So any classes that I teach within the state of Tennessee are under the umbrella of the Tennessee Fire and Codes Academy. So the classes for my business are outside the state of Tennessee. Okay. It really just depends on what shirt I'm wearing, right? Is really what it boils down to. So with that, as far as vetting and bringing instructors on and stuff like that, whether it's for the Tennessee Fire and Codes Academy or the Water Thieves, right? I do have a process where I vet people, right? The business started originally, it was me and people I knew and trusted. So like the start, like if you look at like the founding guys, the guys that really did it, it's a lot of Charlottesville guys, right? Because I worked with them, I knew them. We kind of did all this stuff together. And as time has grown, right, I got guys that that have come from Indiana that are part of my cadre. I have one of my very good friends is from Columbus, Ohio, Keith Thomas. He works for Columbus. He's been on the job there for over 30 years, right? I got guys up north. I got people all over the place, but I know them and I can vouch for all of them. And that's kind of what I pride myself on. And I tell people all the time, whether it's the Tennessee Fire Academy or through my business, unfortunately I can't be at every class.
Right.
I try to be, right. But I can't. And, you know, if I'm not there and you see somebody else with either uniform on there, right? If it's the Water Thieves for my business, or we're in the state of Tennessee and teaching for your fire department, if they're teaching a pump class, they're an extension of me, right? They know just as much as I do, right? I have made sure that they know this information, and you know they're just as sharp, if not sharper, than I am. So I really do make sure that we have guys that know what they're doing and that are passionate about it, right? Because that's the one thing that I've talked to a lot of people who have taken a pump class, and I personally, I think part of that attitude problem that we talked about before, part of that attitude problem is guys that, you know, man, yeah, I'm teaching pumps today. I don't really want to be here. Here's some friction loss, right? That's how a pump looks inside, blah, blah, blah. And you're automatically, because you as the instructor aren't passionate about the topic, you're creating a training scar, whether you realize it or not. Guys don't give a shit about it because you didn't care. So all my guys, we are passionate about it. We love it. We try our damnedest to get you jazzed up about pump operations, which I know is not a sexy topic, but you know, our goal by the end of the class, whatever class it is to make it exciting to you.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, you mentioned it. It's not, to some, it's not a sexy topic. But if you're a driver operator and you could care less about, like, yeah, you just pull some, like, you're the problem, and it's a major, I don't know, maybe I'm looking at it too much, but like, you know, we talked about it earlier. Everything goes right, nobody bats an eye at the driver operator. But when shit goes south, spotlight's on you, and it's, well, what happened? Like, prime example, a good buddy of mine, they had a fire about 2.5 weeks ago, and they were confirmed structure fire, possible entrapment, and they're going down the road, the main road to get to where this house is, and his turbo goes out, and he limps the truck to the scene, and we have pucks. And so he said every single light on his dashboard was on. And he was like, all right, they got it there, gave a size up, working fire on the Charlie side, smoke showing. And he tried to put in pump gear. And for our pucks, you just, instead of the yellow shift pause, you hit a button. He was like, didn't work. And he was like, all right, what was this right there is you have a working fire, possible entrapment. Your shit's not working. I was like, what'd you do? He was like, I just shut the truck off. He said, I shut it off, let it reset, and the truck went into pump gear, and he was good. They took the line off, he charged it, but his captain was like, the next in truck was right behind him, and he was like, hey, just in case, we're gonna play it safe, we're gonna utilize the next truck just in case. But he said he was
Just in
able to
case.
charge, yeah, he was able to charge his line, but at that split second, especially with at least how I see we are teaching, at least in my area, the next generation, they're not going to know what to do. But he was like, all I did was, all right, it's not working. Shut it off. It's like a computer
Yep.
needs to reset itself. But that's where I'm talking. That's where I feel like for me, I want to know more. And like I said, I'm not trying to shoot my organization in the foot because I don't, the way my mindset is, it's not all on my organization to teach me what I want to know. If there are things I want to deep dive in, I have to invest that time. And so
100%.
I love how you're able to do these classes, but it's just one of those things where I'm not afraid to admit, like, I want to know more. It's more than just tank the pump, refill, or recert valve, or whatever the case, charge your line to 110. Like, there's more to it because when, like, if I'm on a reserve truck and shit goes bad, how do I manually override the system that I feel like it's not being taught?
100%, and you know, I try my damnedest to see it from both sides, right? You know, it's the fire department expects you as a driver operator to be super proficient, right? And know everything about that truck. However, in order to do that, I mean, let's be real, I could make it a 6-month pump academy, right? In order to get you to the point where you are super dialed in. And how many organizations can afford for you to be off the rig doing training in like a Top Gun style pump academy for 6 months, right? It's not realistic. So that's why I tell operators, you got to get out. You got to get out and continue to do this stuff. Whether it's, you know, I'm not necessarily saying you got to get out and flow 10,000 gallons a minute every shift, but get outside and talk about it with your crew. Talk about it with the other engine operators. Hey, man, if we had to do this, what are we going to do? If we're doing this, how are we going to hook up? If we have to do this, what do I do? Draw a damn scenario on the board, right? You know, a lot of people think that, you know, when we talk about pumps and hydraulics and the role of the pump operator, it's just doing that friction loss stuff. Man, that is such a small part of it, right?
Right.
People get so wrapped around the axle with the math. You know, yeah, you need to know how to do math. But as far as the attack engine's concerned, you should know your pre-connects. Most of us are running pre-connects in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
You should know what the flow rate is, what the pump pressure is, and that should be committed to memory, right?
Right.
Should be done. The rest of it, the math that we're doing, are weird things, right? And the math doesn't need to be that difficult. You can make pump charge. You can do all kinds of things to make the math easy. But knowing how to hook up, knowing how to deliver water, knowing how to troubleshoot, that's, you're only going to get good at that by actually doing it and talking it through and working with your companies, right? And that's why I tell everybody, you know, if you're only, and I don't care what fire department you're with, but if you're only going to rely on what your fire department provides you, you may be behind the eight ball, right?
Right.
Go out and make friends with other folks across the country. Ask them, man, how do you do it? What does booster backup mean to you, right? What is twin tube drafting mean in your fire department? Do you guys need to do that? That's one of the things that I'm really glad that we started. I took this suggestion from a friend of mine. We started this page separate from the Water Thieves page. I guess it's called a group. I'm not great with social media, but it's a group called the Water Thieves, where we talk water. And I always recommend to anybody, join that group, because it's just firemen from all over the United States that talk about water supply stuff. And I mean, I really don't do anything with it. I moderate it, right? But, you know, people will jump on there all the time. Hey, you know, my fire department's looking at building a pumper tanker. What have other people done? Or my fire department does the booster backup. This is what we have found. Does anybody have anything else to think about? What does dual pumping mean to you? All kinds of stuff like that. So get out there and ask questions. But, you know, the biggest piece that I try to tell anybody is, with that comes the responsibility that you have in yourself on how you bring it back to your organization,
mm-hmm.
right? Because the last thing you want to do is, you know, Danny, you go back and say, well, Charlottesville does it this way, and that's how we need to do it. Or Washington, D.C. does it this way, right? Because what are you going to get? What's the response? This isn't Charlottesville. This isn't D.C.,
right?
Right. So, you know, the best thing, and we tell people in all of our classes, right, bring things back in small, digestible pieces. Don't try to bring the whole damn class back at once, right? Hey, I learned this in this class, or I talked to a guy here. Let's see if it would work here, or what are our thoughts about how it would work in our fire department? So, if you're passionate and want to be good at it, you got to look outside.
Okay.
And you may find that, you know what, your fire department does it perfectly, and everybody else is screwing up, right? And that's good. Right. Hey, man, we do have our shit together. Right. So it's not always that, well, my fire department's doing it wrong. No, there's a reason why our fire department does it and why it works this way. And understanding the why is so beneficial.
Yeah.
So beneficial.
For sure. For sure. Okay. With you owning your own app, your own apparatus, and you said it's an 80s models Mac. Do you see any differences with the pump configuration with those trucks to what's being produced now?
Yeah.
Okay.
My rig being an 88, you know, it is before the NFPA standards came out. Like, the biggest thing that screws people up with that rig is All the pressure gauges for the rig, for all the discharges, they're up top. They're all up top in a row. So discharge number one's gauge might be here, but the actual discharge valve is all the way across the panel on the lower corner. Whereas the standard today says the gauge and the valve has to be within 6 inches of each other. So it's a lot like, so it can be confusing if you're not used to that. And that was something that was always, at least when that engine was up in New Jersey with the department that I'd started with, that was a learning curve because that was the older rig and the newer rigs, they weren't like that, right? They were all paired together. So it's, there's things like that. But then there's a lot of things that are very similar and the same, right? As far as understanding where water comes in, where it goes out, how it moves internally, right? It doesn't really matter how old the truck is. Those basic foundation pieces, they're the same regardless of the truck. And if you can visualize what's going on behind that panel, right, you can troubleshoot a lot of different things. But it instills the importance, and I tell people this all the time, right? The importance of being intimately familiar with your rig. So, obviously, when I was in Charlottesville, I was assigned, when I was on the engine, I was assigned to Engine 7. So I knew Engine 7. I knew everything, everything that made her tick, where everything was. I could pump that truck blindfolded, right? And that's great, but the challenge becomes, all right, Engine 7's in the shop, and now you're on reserve Engine 4, right? All right. So now this is what delineates a good pump operator from a lever puller, right? Do you know your reserves? And if you're in a bigger organization, you may not. The reserve you're getting may be across the city and you've never seen it before. But a good pump operator, when they come in and they're on a reserve, right, they're doing a longer morning check. And I know it sounds simple, right? It almost seems like, duh, why wouldn't you? But I've seen guys, right? They're on a reserve. Yeah, it's engine four. Okay. The transmission selector's on the dash and not on the side. Okay, big deal. Man, whenever I would drive a reserve, I'm doing a good hour, 2 hour check over just to make sure I know where crap is, right? And how things work and this, that, and the other, right? So that's really important to understand too. And I probably the last thing I'll say about, you talked about my older rig compared to what's new today, right? My old rig doesn't have a pressure governor, right? It has a discharge relief valve. And most people don't understand a lot. That's for some, that's older technology. Most people are getting the pressure governors, and because it's easy, right? You set it and, hey, I want it to maintain 150 pounds and it does its thing, right? And there's a time and a place for that style, that technology, pressure governors, everything like that. But what people need to understand is there's a time and a place where a discharge relief valve is beneficial too. And it's something that I always implore any apparatus committee to sit and look and say, hey, do I need to get a pressure governor because everybody else is getting one? Or would a discharge relief valve maybe work better for us? And there are times where it will, times where it won't. But, not every engine is the same, right? Now, what I mean by that is I'm not saying that in a fire department, like for example, in Charlottesville, when I was there, when you got cut loose to drive an engine, you could drive any engine in the fleet. Okay, I get that because at its core, all the pumpers operate the same. Maybe this one's a puck and I have to, push this button to engage the pump. Whereas engine seven is a midship mounted pump, so I gotta throw the lever down and then put it in drive, right? So there are nuances there. But pumpers are pumpers are pumpers are pumpers. You just gotta know the nuances and how things are laid out. So conversely, when you in Charlottesville, if you were a truck operator, you got released on the 95-foot mid-mount platform, but that didn't mean you could drive the tiller. You had to get released on each individual one, right? And I think that's a fair way to do it because they are two totally different pieces of machinery. Pumpers, they're different, but they're a lot more the same than they are different. So, you should take the time to understand the differences between your pumpers, right? And taking the mindset that a pumper is a pumper is a pumper is a pumper, yeah, that's true. You should know how to put it in gear, but you got to know the nuances between each of those rigs, right?
No, for sure. Because you mentioned that, and I immediately thought we have a reserve truck where it never goes into pump gear the first time. Never. And I like whenever we get new people that are just kind of learning and we have to go check it. And I'm like, yeah, you check this one just to see what they're going to do,
Yeah,
how they're
see
going to
what they're gonna
react.
do.
And it's like, hey, this thing's not. And I'm like, all right, try it again. And then it goes. And I'm like, just remember, this truck always does
That's
that.
how it is.
So,
Yep.
like how you mentioned when you're on a reserve to go over it, that's 100% facts. Because I'm sure every department has and every organization has a truck that does that, where it's wonky. It never goes into pump gear the first time, it takes two or three times. So, I love that you mentioned that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You gotta know the intimacy, the intimate details of your rig.
Absolutely. Okay. I'm going to kind of go back a little bit. I'm going to
Okay.
ask you, what does the term aggressive mean to you? Because it's a buzzword in the fire service today.
Yeah. aggressive, that's a great question, right? What does aggressive mean to me? I don't think it's a bad thing. And a lot of places where I have been, or places I've visited, you use that term and it automatically puts people on the defensive, right? And it shouldn't. Aggressive means that the aggressive and reckless are two different things, right? Aggressive doesn't necessarily mean reckless, all right? They're two different meanings, right? Aggressive to me means that I'm going after it. I know my job. I'm capable of doing my job. I don't need to have my hand held to do my job. And I can be trusted to get it done, right? And I know exactly what needs to be done in order to have the desired result, right? And that I am able to freely think to calculate and make the appropriate decisions on my own to affect the desired outcome, right? Whether that be, the choice to VES, whether that be the choice to, hey, you know what? The hydrant is in front of us and I need to reverse out to give the first two engine water rather than lay in because I'm going to block the truck, right? Whether that is, hey, I'm going to heavy hook this hydrant because I can tell, you know what, this fire is in the attic and it's going to run the building, right? Or whatever it may be. So a lot of people will use that negatively. And I think it's okay to say that I'm a aggressive fireman, right? And I think that is a little bit right now in our culture, that is being accepted a little bit better, that I'm an aggressive fireman. But if I come around and say I'm an aggressive operator, right? Whoa, what does that mean? People automatically think, oh, that you're going to be driving like a jackass and trying to run people off the road. No, that's not what that means. That means I am going to aggressively position my rig so that way the fireman can aggressively operate off the rig. Right. So it has a negative connotation, but it really shouldn't. Okay. Reckless is driving like a jackass. Reckless is positioning your ladder truck where it's going to tip over, right? Like doing stuff like that, not setting out riggers, whatever it may be. We see all kinds of wild stuff. But aggressive is not a bad thing. And in fact, I tell people all the time, especially in our aerial classes and our pump classes, right? When it comes to positioning, I want you to position aggressively, right? I want you to jump the curb and nose into that hydrant if it's going to leave that road open for the ladder truck to come in behind you, right? Yeah, you know what? Truck might get a little dirty. Okay, so what? We'll clean it afterwards. Because at the end of the day, it's a fire truck. It's designed to work. It's designed to do its job, right? It's not a parade piece.
I love that you brought that up, because too many times, and it's more so up north, that you see that type of aggressiveness when it comes to engines, and people just don't get it. Like, sometimes the engine will hop a curb, or what they call beach it, and they're not doing it to be cool. They're doing it because they have, the driver knows, if I park here, the ladder's screwed. They're not going to have their best advantage to get to this structure, and which is why they do it. So I love that you mentioned it, because whenever I see it, I look at the whole picture and I'm like, they did it for a reason. Now, I'm sure there are individuals who have done it where it's like, bro, that was not needed. But when it happens, there's a reason behind it. And I love how you talked about it.
100%, right? And I like to tell people when we talk positioning in our classes, right? If you look at some of the bigger cities that are aggressive, that see a lot of fire duty, that do this a lot, very rarely do you see trucks parked in a straight line.
Right.
Right?
Right.
They're all angled and this, that, and the other. And it looks like, what the hell is going on here? But if you step back and look at the big picture like you're talking about, oh, well, that rig angled this way because it's a mid-mount platform and he wanted to increase the scrub area. Mm-hmm. And that engine is angled this way because all the hose comes off the rear of the truck, so they're pointing the hose bed, right? So if you take the time to actually look at it, yeah, there's a reason why we're not in a parade line. We shouldn't be, right? Mm-hmm. Most of the time, most fire scenes probably don't need to be in a parade line. Or if we do, we're limiting our functionality off the rig. Right.
And that you mentioned, so I'd like to talk about it. So I was on a ladder truck, and it's a mid mount, and that's what I did. The side the structure was on, I always cocked the ass in towards that area for the scrub area, for a reach, because one thing I've learned through all of the classes I've taken, you can extend hose, but you can't extend an aerial.
And extend that ladder.
So
you can't extend that ladder.
That's very 100%. Important. Now,
and that's
go ahead. No, you go ahead. Go ahead.
I was going to say, you know, no matter where you go, you always get that rub, engine, truck, this, that, and the other. But
yes,
and I tell all my guys all the time, right? Water flows through my veins, but I also know, right? My job is to allow the truck company to do theirs, right? So just because, right, I think that I prefer to do pump operations and engine work, that doesn't mean that I'm going to position myself in a way that screws the truck company, right? They have a resource that is important for the overall mission, but that resource is limited in that it can only go a certain length. So it's got to be in the right position in order to be used. Mm-hmm. My resource, that's why we carry all this hose. I can be wherever I need to be to make the mission happen. Yeah, it might be more hose to pick up, but I can expand and contract, whereas they can't as easily.
Right. For sure. For sure. Now, would you say, if I know one thing I do, our new engine we ordered, everything's going to come off the rear. But uh-huh. With the current trucks we have now, we have some lines that come off the rear, and we do have crosslays. And so most of the time, 8 times out of 10, I'd say we're going to pull a crosslay, and we know mm-hmm. We know the amount that's on there and where it's capable of getting us. But one thing I like to do is I also like to kind of position, like I kind of look at the engine as an aerial to the where I'm talking about, where like, all right, where's my crossleg going to sit? Because I like to make it easier. I like to make the stretch easier for the crews in the back. So that's one thing I always keep in the back of my mind too.
100%. And so in Charlottesville, when I got hired there, we were transitioning. We had a bunch of engines that were pucks, and all the attack lines, all the 1¾-inch attack lines were cross lays, right? Mm-hmm. The rear had a pre-connected 2½ and then supply hose, right? So for us during that time period, it was cross lay. And it's fine. I don't care. Crosslays have their advantages. Rear pre-connects have their advantages. They're tools in the toolbox. If I'm building my perfect engine, I'm going to have one of each, right? Because mm-hmm. there's an application for one in certain scenarios and one in the other, right? But what we found as a fire department, a lot of operators are doing exactly what you're talking about, right? I'm worried. I'm trying to line this thing up to make it easy for the guys. And what our culture had at the time, a lot of people were lining that cross lay perfectly with the door. So they would be able, the crew would just be able to pull straight to the door. It's good for the engine company,
back
but
to
it
the
was
truck.
Screwing the truck every damn time. So at the when I was getting released while we were waiting for the new engine build that we ended up building, and engine 5 and 7 were the first two that made this transition. We went away from the puck and we went to a more traditional city style engine where all the lines come off the rear. Right. We did that for a couple reasons. One, you know, it helped us clean up our hose bed and everything like that. Keep everything nice and tidy. Didn't have crosslays going over the pump operator, all that good stuff. But it drilled in our operators to pull past the building, right? That was one of the advantages. So a lot of people are like, well, we can only do that with – we can only pull past if we're driving the newer engines that have things off the rear. And I said, no, that's not true. With a rig that has a crosslay, I can still pull past, and I can still help that company, or the engine company. All I got to do is pull past and angle the nose.
And angle it. Exactly.
The building.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
I'm going to try and turn that rig as much so that way the crosslays, instead of being perpendicular to the street, they're more in line with where that door is. They're just a little bit further away. Mm-hmm. So the operator can still do things like that. Just like if I'm driving a rig that has rear pre-connects, all I'm going to do is I'm going to pull past and I'm going to turn away. So yep. Now the ass end of the truck is pointing towards the door.
Absolutely.
Right. So, yes, absolutely. 100%. And those are the things to understand. That's how I can be a good steward to the truck company. Hey guys, you have your room to do whatever you need to. And I can still help the guys on my engine. Hey man, I'm lining you up to be able to make it easy to pull these lines.
Yes,
right.
Sir. Yes, sir.
And those are things that the operator needs to think about.
Absolutely. Okay. What's your take on, because I think you mentioned Charlottesville does it, which in my opinion, I think it's a benefit. Some may disagree, but a years of service clause before you're assigned or allowed to drive or promote.
Yeah. So, you know, it's it's a sticky subject, right? I don't like hard and fast, like it shall be this. Right. Because you're always going to have this anomaly.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But at the same time, it needs to be fair across the board. OK. My concern always with having a hard and fast, you need 5 years of service before you can do whatever. Right. There's a difference between 5 years of, you know, meaningful service where you've gone and educated yourself and done what you need to do to better yourself for the next whatever position you're trying to do, and existing for 5 years, right? And I've been plenty of places where, oh yeah, a guy existed for 5 years and now he's eligible to do something, right? So I think I kind of like a blend of the two. If your organization, of course, can afford to do that. Some places they don't have the luxury of saying, you need to wait 5 years before you can drive. Because, man, I need you to drive next shift,
right? Right.
But at the same time, that doesn't mean you shouldn't know how to do it. So personally, I like a blend of it, right? You should have some time on the job and learn this particular skill and have certification or documented training to show that you know how to do this job before you do the next step, before you do the next step. And like I said, some places can do that, some cannot, right? And I recognize that, I understand that. But it needs to be, I get nervous when it's a big thing here in certain fire departments in the state of Tennessee where they are forced because they're more rural, they have smaller organizations, and they don't have the depth in their roster to have all the senior people do all the different things. So there are some places where folks will come out of their 10-week recruit school through the fire academy, have walked in having no fire service training at all, get out of recruit school, and the first day on the job, they're driving the engine, right? So, and it's because it's them and somebody else in
Right.
the right seat,
Right.
you know, the right front seat. That may be an officer, it may be a firefighter.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it is definitely a struggle, but you know, they're, in my opinion, a blend between the two. If you can have some years of service and actually get some time under your belt to know what the job of being a firefighter is before you start pumping and driving and doing all that, that's only going to help you as a pump operator, because you're going to know, hey, that nozzleman expects water right now because he needs to go do this. If I've never been on the end of that line waiting for water to come to a nozzle, I don't understand how important it is to know my shit, know how to put the pump in gear, know how to get that line charged, know how to troubleshoot, right? That is why having that years of service and some experience under your belt before you transition into that next step can be beneficial. But again, I recognize that not everybody can do that.
Absolutely. No, I totally get you. Okay. When it comes to outside training, obviously, I'm pretty sure you're a fan of outside training, regardless of what subject it is, but how important is it for individuals to get outside their four walls?
Man, it is so important. I can't stress enough how important it is to get some outside training, like you said, regardless of the subject, right? It doesn't matter if it's pump operations, truck company operations, search, fire attack, doesn't matter, right? If for nothing else, you get a different perspective, right? And I always tell people, whenever you go to any training class, you got to walk in there. I don't care if it's the most boring topic in the fire service or whatever you're talking about. But walk in there with an open mind, because you may pick up one thing, and that one thing may have a really positive impact on you personally, you and your career, your fire department, whatever, right? Not going in there saying, man, I know how to force a door. I've been on the job for, you know, 20 years. I know how to force a door. I learned that when I was a recruit. Well, you know what? Things change. And you know what? You might see a little tip or a technique that just makes it that much easier. That's what it's all about, right? I want it to be as functional and easy for me, because that helps the citizens we're protecting, right? That's really what it's all about. We want to be as efficient as possible. So whether you expect to learn something groundbreaking or not, go in there with an open mind, right? Hear things from people on the outside your four walls, like you had mentioned. That's one of the things I love about FDIC. And I routinely will sit in classes that, you know, yeah, I know about pump operations, but I want to hear what my buddy Bill Atkins has to say, because he does it differently up in Ohio. I want to hear what, you know, other individuals have to say, because nobody does it perfectly. We can all learn from each other. So outside training is a must.
Love it. Okay. The wellness and truly being there portion. You know, you mentioned earlier that you weren't afraid to ruffle feathers, but you know, the fire service has those individuals that they just won't admit it. They won't admit that they don't know something. I'm not really, I'm not sure what it is, if it's the bravado, if it's the profession in us, but you know, I'm always wanting to learn things to better myself, not only for me, but hopefully I could pass it on to the next generation coming up. Like, don't make the same mistakes I did. So when it comes to like truly being there and wellness in the fire service, what's your take on the direction we're going?
I think, you know, again, I haven't been in the fire service for 50 years, right? And a lot has changed. I think as a whole, firefighter wellness being a really hot button issue currently, it's changed a lot from even when I got in the fire service, right? When I got in the fire service, you know, there was, and I know it was worse before I got in there, but there was a lot to the point where we would mess with you until we could find where we were breaking you, right? And I'm not saying that that's necessarily wrong or we necessarily need to go back to that. I'm saying it's different. That was the fire service I came in before. And now the fire service is, has transitioned to being more mindful about the needs, both physically and mentally, for our firefighters. And I think it's good. I think that is a really good step. And I'll be honest, one of the things, the hardest thing for me, when I made the transition from being on shift to coming into the job I have now, is that brotherhood and wellness and looking out for one another aspect of the job that you have when you're on shift. Right? Yeah, we would break each other's balls on shift, but I knew when somebody was not feeling it, right? And I knew when, you know what, I shouldn't be messing with Danny. Danny, what's going on? I can tell something's off today. Like, what do we need to do? Do you need something? Do you need to go home? What can I do to help you? Right? Because we were a family. We were tight knit. We were working together. And that's how it should be, right? That we should be able to have fun, but we should also know each other well enough to be able to help each other when we need to. So I went from that to now I have an office job and I'm in the field teaching, but I don't have a crew. I have the different instructors that help me, but I don't have a crew that I walk in with every day that knows me or even has that brotherhood aspect. Or, hey, you know what? We had a really shitty call. Once we get off, let's go have some beers for lunch, after our shift tomorrow, whatever it is, right? You don't have that. And it is definitely a component of being on the line and in the fire service that I personally miss the most. And I think it is great that I see other people. It seems like now across the board, from the outside looking in, almost, being off the line, looking into those of you that are still on the line, I do feel that there's more of this drive to look out for one another. There's more of this drive to, you know what? Let's take the picture, right? Let's remember this, because in 20 years, yeah, I know that fire, but man, in 20 years, I forgot that it was Danny and I that were sitting there that made the push, or had to go to the roof or whatever. And just those of you that are still on the line, you're doing the Lord's work, as cheesy as that sounds. And you do need to look out for one another. You need to look out for yourself. I think it is great that people are willing to talk about their struggles, whereas when I came in the fire service, that really wasn't something you did. And if you did, you were looked down upon. And I can only imagine what it was like when my mentors were coming up. Like, that definitely didn't get talked about. But yeah, it's important for us to be there for one another. It's important for us to be there for ourselves, right? And recognize and do some self-reflection to know, am I good or am I not? Do I need help or do I not? Right? I need to throw a shout out to my younger brother who's on the job in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Allentown, they're a busy job. They see some fire. And my brother has gone to more fires than I went to when I was on the line. And I'm proud as hell for him. And he's gone through some stuff, both personally or whatever. And he was adult enough to admit that he had to deal with something, right? And that's not something that happens or would have happened 20 years ago necessarily. So I am beyond proud of him for being able to say, yep, I got a problem. I got to handle this problem so I can be right. And he handled it and he's good, right? And, talk to each other, look out for each other.
Love it. Okay. Just a curiosity question. Does your brother share the same passion for pumps or like you or
Oh yeah,
no?
absolutely. Absolutely. He
Okay.
does. And in fact, he helps me teach some of my classes.
Awesome.
So depending on scheduling and where we are in the country, he'll come out and help me. We have a class scheduled in Massachusetts later this year, so he'll be helping me with that. But yeah, he definitely does, and yeah, he definitely has the passion for it.
Okay. But like brother to brother rivalry, because I don't have a brother, I have a sister, but I can only imagine with two brothers. Is there a better pump operator than the other? Like, do you guys
I'll
both?
tell you this. I'll tell you this. My brother, and it's honestly, it's the best joke. It's the best joke, and I give him credit because he is witty. He goes around and because he's always like, man, people are always coming up to me and being like, man, I saw your brother on this, or I read this article, or I got your brother's book, or whatever. And he always like, man, screw that guy. I taught him everything he knows. I wrote that book and he put his name on it. So he does that all the time. So it's we have a good friendly rivalry. And I'll be
Awesome.
the first to admit that boy has gone to way more fires than I ever went to, and he's got the experience, man.
Okay. All right. As far as what is one sort of little training anybody, any driver operator can do with their companies, when they're out at work, or whether it's a career or volunteer, but what's one thing they can do to help their skill set?
The simplest and really all you need is an engine and a fire hydrant, right? One of the simplest skills that you can do to not only build muscle memory, but instill confidence in yourself, right? One of the drills that I would do all the time, usually once a cycle, and people looked at me like I was freaking crazy. But I would take the rig out, whether the backseat firefighter wanted to participate or not, it didn't matter. If he did, great. If he didn't, I would just put a nozzle on the discharge, right? But pull up to my hydrant, I put it in pump gear, I charge a line, and I make my water supply before I run out of tank water, right? Just being able to do that. Is it a realistic drill? You can go either way, right? And what I would tell people is, I had a 750-gallon tank flowing 200 gallons a minute, right? You do the math, you figure out how long you can flow the water for, about 3 minutes, right? So, with that being said, right, I know that most of the fires that I went to, it wasn't impossible, but it was not as likely that that nozzleman would be flowing water for 3 minutes continuously, 3.5 minutes continuously. So I knew that if I could get my water supply within 3.5 minutes, man, I'm going to be fine on the fire ground because he's probably going to be flowing for a little bit, shutting down, making a push in, repositioning, getting into the room, opening up again, right? Flowing. So really that 3.5 minute time frame, it may be more like 8 minutes, maybe 10 minutes before I'm empty, right? Depending on what's going on.
Right.
But my goal is, hey, worst case scenario, if I can get my water supply hooked up, water coming in before 3.5 minutes, I'm golden, right? And that just builds a lot of confidence personally, or it did for me at least.
Right.
It's easy. I can do it by myself. Rig's not out of service. The only length of hose that I really have to pull
That's right.
is the section going to the hydrant, right?
Right. Right.
Or if the guy riding backwards wants to pull the line. So now I got one pre-connect off. I'm
Right.
still in service, right? So,
Okay.
yeah, just something simple.
Okay. One last personal question, because it came to my
Okay.
mind, and I was like, there's no better person to ask than you. All right. So
Uh-oh.
back in the day, in North Carolina, it does get cold. We will have parts of the year where it drops below freezing for a couple days, a week or so, whatever the case may be. Our administration, when it drops to a certain degree, they particularly don't want trucks sitting outside. And I get it.
Sure.
Like, they want the trucks running to keep it warm, keep that pump warm. But I had a question. And I asked the question and I couldn't get an answer. And like I said, no shot at my administration, because
Sure.
I'm happy they didn't just bullshit me. They were like, hey, we honestly don't know. We just to err on the side of caution, we want the trucks running. All right, cool, got it. I wanted to know a little bit more, so I emailed a fire apparatus representative who apparently contacted my administration and was like, hey, one of your guys asked this question. And I don't want to say I got in trouble for it, but like it raised some eyebrows. And I'm like, I just wanted to know
I just
the
want to
answer.
know.
So my
Sure.
question to you is, can a pump truly freeze when it's below 32? And I only ask because two of the biggest manufacturers right now are in Wisconsin. It's cold there, and they still pump trucks and make trucks. So, personal question, can that happen?
Yeah, so one of the things, and I will forward it to you after this, after we get off, but for those listening, Waterous actually has an article that they published. You can get it on their website that talks about this very issue and really all the variables that go into whether a pump, like when a pump actually freezes,
Yeah.
right? I hate to say it, but it's not as cut and dry like at 31 degrees, your pump is frozen solid, right?
Okay.
Because there's a lot of things that go into that. Is the pump casing full? How much water is in the pump casing, right? Well, the more water that's in there, the longer it takes to freeze. So if it's at 30 degrees out, it's not going to freeze instantly. It might take a while. But if it's at negative 30, well, then yeah, it might freeze right now. Another thing that goes into play is travel times, right? How long are you going down the road in these below freezing temperatures, right? Depending on the response line, and I don't know the numbers right off the top of my head, but that Waterous article, it breaks it down. They say if it's this temperature and you're driving for this long, well, then maybe you want to drain the pump and you want to go to your calls with a dry pump. But in these situations, you probably can continue to run a wet pump. And when you get to wherever you're going, keep the truck running, put it in pump gear, and recirculate water. So it really is. I can tell you based on what I did in the climates that I worked in, and this is just my experience. This is not a always and all ever, right? But in Charlottesville, we would run wet pumps, right? The pumps would stay wet even in the wintertime. But our rule was when you got on scene or got to wherever you're going, whether it was a ripping fire or a lift assist, the pump operator engages the pump and recirculates water, right? That way, the water in motion, it won't freeze, right? The pump, the casing itself won't freeze, water in motion won't freeze, and you're good to go. Now, what you have to worry about is the water in your drain lines go into your gauges. So me as a driver operator in cold weather, every morning I would make sure that I opened all my drains and made sure that all the water was out of my drain lines, because on my rig it was tied to my gauges too. So I didn't want my gauges to freeze. And then I would disconnect the pre-connects off the rear and just make sure there was no water left in the tubing going through the hose bed. Just make sure any water that was there would drain out, just so that way that doesn't freeze and cause ice that would cause a blockage at the nozzle. So then, and then once I let it drain in the morning, I just reconnect it and we're still pre-connected back in service. But I just would throughout the day just make sure, yeah, there's no water that's accumulated or anything like that. So that way the guys don't find a nice, ice slug at the end of the nozzle later on. But yeah, for those listening, I would definitely check out Waterous's website, Waterous Pumps. They have a great article on winter operations and what to do precautionary for your pumps and all that good stuff.
And the last question I always like to ask my guests, where would you like to see yourself before you decide to hang it all up?
Ooh, man. That's a wild question because, I never thought, it's a question that I got asked in my interview in Charlottesville when I was taking the firefighter test and going through all those interviews. And I remember the answer that I gave, and I am not where I thought I was going to be at that point in time. So it's pretty wild, right? It's really wild to look back. I think when I hang it all up, I definitely hope to continue making an impact teaching. I definitely hope to, hopefully maybe write another book on water supply stuff. And I really just, I hope to leave the fire service better than I found it, right? Because that's honestly all I want to do, right? I just want to leave it better than I found it. I want firefighters to understand the why, not just the, like what I was taught on some of this stuff when I got into the fire service. This is how we do it because, just because we've always done it that way. I want people to understand why we're putting engines on hydrants, why we're doing twin tube drafting, why the booster backup helps, why it's important to know how to move big water, right? I'll be happy if when I hang it up, I've spread that message. So.
Love it. Love it. Okay. And as far as I always call this like a shameless plug, if an individual or department organization, a chief wants to contact you to bring the water thieves to them, how could they go about doing so?
The best thing to do is you can either email me at thewaterthieves@gmail.com. Just send me an email. We can do that. You can reach out to me on social media, either my personal social media on Facebook, Andy Saccadato, or you can reach out to the Water Thieves Facebook page and we'll get to you there. So, yeah.
Okay. All right. Andy, I appreciate I've wanted to make this happen. It's been able we've finally been able to do this. Like I said, me and you, we share that same mindset. And I know not everybody's going to agree, but that's fine. That's what makes us humans humans. But I love the fact that I love what you're doing. Here afterwards we'll talk about it when this interview's over, but I definitely am my ears are perked up knowing that I didn't realize how close you were to me. So now that I know how close you are and what you do, I will definitely be taking the drive out there to further my education. Because it's something I've been trying to find. And I do have a buddy out in Colorado who holds a class. He does at the Denver Mile High Conference. They do like a driver operator class. And I was like, all right, I can go to Denver. Not saying I won't still, but now that you're a
Sure.
little closer for me, we definitely
Sure.
have some stuff to talk about for sure. But I appreciate you coming on. I appreciate you allowing the guests to hear your story. I love what you're doing. I'm sure there are plenty of others who love the driver operator portion, that love and passion you bring to the fire service. It's awesome to hear. I did not know that, but it's awesome to hear that Chief David Rhodes and FDIC and Fire Engineering, how they're allowing this to happen. I hope that it is successful for you, and I hope it continues to spread for others that love the driver operator role. And I just want to say thank you for coming on, buddy.
Thank you, Danny. I really do appreciate it. Thank you, everybody, for listening, and thank you for the opportunity to, talk about water.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I appreciate you.